This is Micro News, the podcast where Matt and I...
Hello.
...talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news this month. I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is our last episode of Micro News for 2020. We won't be having a December episode, but there will be a December episode of Microbe Talk for you all to enjoy next month. Right, Matt, do you want to kick us off?
Research out of Copenhagen has found a link between microorganisms living in the dust of children's beds and the children's own bacteria. The correlations suggest that microorganisms may reduce a child's risk of developing several conditions, including asthma, allergies, and autoimmune disease later on in life. I'm afraid that although you can't see them, our beds are absolutely teeming with microbial life. And it's this life that the scientists are saying can help us become resilient to various diseases and conditions. The researchers analysed bed dust samples from the beds of 577 infants and compared them to respiratory samples from 542 children, making it the largest study of its kind. It's already clear that a high diversity of microorganisms in the home contributes to the development of a child's resistance to a whole host of diseases and allergies. But to get better at treating those diseases, we need to understand the process by which microorganisms emerge during the earliest stages of life, and it seems the bed plays an important role. 930 different types of bacteria and fungi were found in the bed dust, and interestingly, the richness of species differed significantly depending on where the home was. Rural homes had significantly higher levels of bacteria compared to urban homes. This isn't that surprising, as previous studies have told us that city dwellers have a less diverse gut flora, presumably due to the fact they spend less time outdoors and in contact with nature. Pets, siblings, and rural living all contribute to a lowered risk of developing autoimmune diseases, and the next steps of the research is seeing whether the differences in bacterial flora in bed dust can be directly correlated to the development of disease like asthma and allergies.
An article published in our very own journal, Microbiology, was in the news this month. Researchers from the University of Warwick have been developing a pig lung model to investigate cystic fibrosis in lab conditions. The lungs that they use are a byproduct of the meat industry. Because they're the right size and are similar to human lungs, pig lungs make a really effective research model for cystic fibrosis. The research team, which includes members Esther Sweeney and Freya Harrison, wanted to see how the bacteria Staphylococcus aureus behaves in the lungs of people with cystic fibrosis. Similar studies have been carried out in mouse models, but in mouse lungs, abscesses form, which is extremely rare in people, so that means it's not a great model for cystic fibrosis. The researchers used a synthetic mucus that mimics the mucus that occurs in the lungs of people with cystic fibrosis. They used this mucus to see how Staphylococcus aureus infections behave in pig lung models. They found that the bacteria tend to aggregate in this mucus instead of invading the lung tissue and causing abscesses like in the mouse models. This was a great step forward in better understanding staph infections in people with cystic fibrosis, and could pave the way to develop new treatment strategies. Usually, if a person with cystic fibrosis gets a bacterial infection, they're treated with antibiotics. This doesn't really tend to help with the symptoms of lung disease, and with rising antibiotic resistance, it may not be the most effective way to treat the infection. If you're interested in finding out more about this work, check out the research article in Microbiology. There is also a great video on our YouTube channel where Freya explains a bit more about their pig lung model.
With the current pandemic firmly lodged in our brains, it's pretty difficult to think back to the previous massive disease outbreaks. But if you cast your mind back to 2015, the big news story was the Zika outbreak. Hundreds of children were being born with brain deformities like microcephaly, and the World Health Organization declared it a public health emergency of international concern, a label only given to major global health emergencies. Whilst infections are down, the threat still remains, which is why it's quite exciting that there is some new research. 10,000 compounds have been tested using a wide range of drug screening techniques to try and find a cure for Zika. Researchers were surprised to find that a widely used antibiotic called methacycline was effective at preventing brain infections and reducing neurological problems associated with the virus in mice. They also found that drugs originally designed to combat Alzheimer's disease and inflammation may also help to fight infection. Researchers were looking for drugs that prevent the virus from reproducing by blocking the activity of a protein with a catchy name, NS2B-NS3 Zika virus protease. I'll just call it NS2B. As well as the large-scale screen of over 10,000 compounds, the other exciting part of the research was the use of technological advances. The researchers fed the results of the screen into a computer and used artificial intelligence to learn what makes a compound good at blocking the NS2B protein.
I know that Micronews is usually a COVID-19-free zone, but this month I'm going to break that rule and talk about some of the major scientific advances that mark the beginning of the end of the pandemic. This November, four different groups have shared emerging data on their SARS-CoV-2 vaccine trials, all of which are extremely promising. Before I talk about these vaccines more, I just want to clarify that the data provided so far have not been peer-reviewed. This means that the results are preliminary, and the phase 3 stage of all of these vaccine trials is still in progress. As more information comes in, the results might change, and an external impartial expert has not yet been able to review and assess the validity of the research. Right, so let's talk about these vaccines then. On November 9th, Pfizer and BioNTech issued a press release to share results from their interim analyses. They announced that their RNA vaccine candidate appears to be more than 95% effective after two doses. 2 days later, on November 11th, came two more vaccine announcements. Moderna, another US-based company, shared a press release on their vaccine candidate. Like the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, Moderna used virus RNA to train the immune system and prepare defenses against the virus with no risk of causing infection. Also, like the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, this was shown to be 95% effective. On the same day, the Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology and Microbiology in Moscow also announced an interim analysis of their Sputnik V vaccine, showing efficacy of 92%. Now, where the Sputnik V vaccine differs from the other two is in what it contains. The Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna vaccines are both RNA vaccines, whereas Sputnik is a viral vector vaccine. Last but not least came the fourth announcement of the month from a partnership between Oxford University and AstraZeneca in the UK. Their data, published in The Lancet, provides more detail into the protection their vaccine provides into different age groups and the dosing recommendations. The predictions about efficacy of this vaccine are a little broader, with data showing the vaccine to be 62 to 90% effective. Okay, so that is a lot of information, and not even the tip of the iceberg of what will determine how usable these vaccines are in real-world conditions. For example, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has to be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is not exactly realistic for the majority of healthcare settings, especially in lower-income countries. Some vaccines have a shorter expiry date, some are more expensive. There is still a lot to consider, but the key thing is that all of them are safe, and soon the most vulnerable people can start receiving some protection from the virus.
It's no secret that rising rates of antibiotic resistance are a major global concern. They haven't gone away just because we're in the middle of a pandemic. Neisseria gonorrhoeae is one of the 12 priority pathogens and has well and truly earned its place there. Some strains have developed resistance to all effective antibiotics. Resistant strains of Neisseria meningitidis, which causes bacterial meningitis, have also emerged. Neisseria are so quick at evolving resistance because of their intrinsic biology. They acquire genes from other bacteria much faster than normal, and they actually have a suboptimal DNA repair system, which leads to a lot of mutations, all meaning that antibiotic resistance can easily emerge. The diseases also affect so many people around the world that they also have lots of opportunities to evolve. A research team in Quebec may have had a major breakthrough in the fight against Neisseria. They've demonstrated the efficacy of a simple molecule, unnamed at the moment, in bacterial cultures and in models. It's really exciting because the molecule is accessible and inexpensive, so could greatly help in the fight against Neisseria. One of the other benefits is the molecule's specificity. The researchers noted that it only affects pathogenic Neisseria, We have other beneficial Neisseria species in the upper respiratory system, and it doesn't affect them. Due to the speed at which resistance can occur in Neisseria, the researchers did test to see whether any resistance had developed. While there were strains that were less sensitive to the treatment, they seem to have completely lost their virulence. The scientists are now hoping to modify the compound structure to make it more efficient.
And my final story this month is about microbes in space. Always an exciting topic. A huge amount of mineral and precious metal mining on Earth is carried out using microbes. They accelerate chemical reactions with acids or enzymes that they produce. Microbes have been extracting nutrients from rocks for billions of years, so they're pretty good at it. There are a lot of extreme environments here on Earth. Temperatures, different pH levels, different atmospheres of pressure, to name just a few. And believe me when I say that for every environment this planet has to offer, there is a microbe that has evolved to thrive there. But there is one thing that is consistent across all environments on Earth, and that is gravity. Researchers in Edinburgh have conducted an experiment to investigate whether microorganisms could extract elements from rocks in zero gravity. They sent a bunch of mining microbes and rocks containing rare elements up to the International Space Station to see what would happen. One of these microbes, Sphingomonas desiccabilis, was able to extract elements from rocks in zero gravity just as well as it could on Earth. Eventually, biomining could be used to harvest useful materials for human settlements in space. They could use asteroids or planetary rocks, and this would save elements being shipped from Earth.
Thanks for listening. You may have already heard, but we're now on Instagram. If you want to check it out, our handle is @microbiosoc. In the meantime, we hope you're keeping safe, and we'll see you on the next episode.